You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 10th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we have a special guest rogue this week, David Gorski. Dave, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
Hey, Dave.
Jay is on vacation this week because it's his birthday tomorrow. Tomorrow as we record this. So we had Dave on to take his place. So Dave, you have to take Jay's place this week.
Oh, you know that no one can ever take Jay's place, but I will do my best.
Do you have a
please do.
Do you have a machine that makes Star Wars blaster and lightsaber effects?
God. No, I want a vacation from that for a week.
So for those who don't know, David is the managing editor of Science-Based Medicine and a regular contributor to that. He also runs his own blog under a different name.
Oh, you it's the worst kept secret in God knows.
Been very active in the health fraud and science-based medicine community for quite some time, at least over 10, 15 years, correct? What year did you start blogging?
December 2004. And before that, I was active on...
even around?
And before that, I was active on Usenet, if you remember what that is.
Usenet? I do. Holy crap.
Gosh. I do not.
Good for you, Kara.
God, why did we hire her?
She doesn't know what MySpace was either.
I was totally on MySpace. I was even on Friendster.
Okay. Friendster.
You're going to make me feel really old here.
Oh, come on. I remember when the goddamn World Wide Web was born.
Yes.
Well, yes. So do I, unfortunately.
93 people.
Six minutes for an image to upload.
Kara, have you ever been in a chat room?
Yes, I have been in a chat room. I remember the early days of the interwebs. In 93, yeah. I was 10 years old, so it was prime time for me to get excited about the internet.
Yeah, it's perfect.
So, David, recently, like in the last year or so, you have been the target of Mike Adams from Natural News. He's really, really been picking on you.
Yeah, it's actually only been since about April. However, as I mentioned to you before the show, he's printed about 32 posts about me since then, by my count.
Oh,
yeah. So he's cyberstalking you.
Yeah, I don't know. And to be honest, I don't quite understand. It's not like I'm Paul Offit or something like that.
I mean, obviously you're a prominent in the science-based medicine community, but it does seem like they just are picking a villain. And then trying to make it seem like you're the ringmaster of the whole thing, you know?
Well, it's good for the ego. It's bad for everything else.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. But I mean, it's kind of like they want to portray it as a conspiracy. They don't want it to seem like a grassroots effort or like there's individual people who independently came up with the same opinion about things.
And you're in cahoots with Randy, clearly.
Well,
you have to be evil.
Well, I mean, there are pictures of me and Randy in the same room and even one of us sitting on the same couch at TAM one year. So
scandal.
Horrible, horrible, horrible. But, you know, through the last 4 months or so, he's insinuated that I'm a pedophile. He's insinuated Jeez. That I'm in cahoots with Dr. Farid Fata. You probably don't know who he is, or you may.
Yeah.
You do know who he is.
Yeah, we covered it.
I do.
You
yeah.
did cover it. Okay. It. Mm-hmm. Simply because we basically practice in the same area, and also there was a bad bit of luck in that Fata happened to rent office space in the same building that a joint effort between my cancer center and another hospital had office space, which is, the smoking gun. Of course, I've never met the guy. I didn't even really know who he was until the news story broke. So
nothing flimsy about that at all. Nothing.
Yeah, that's like the textbook definition of circumstantial evidence. But it is amazing how they have their narrative. And then they can filter the world through that narrative, right? They just look for these little tidbits of information that are totally innocent, but they just weave them into this sinister narrative that they've created. And I think, Mike Adams always struck me as somebody who's just making shit up, that he, on some level, knows he's full of shit. He's just gaming his audience to make money off of them, it all seems a little bit too calculated.
Oh, I think so. I mean, Mike Adams got his start basically as a Y2K scammer. I learned all of this about him, and that's basically how he got his start. And then he discovered natural health somehow.
So I know we've had this conversation, but what a lot of people bring up when they see what's going on is, why don't you take legal action against him for what's clearly libel? I mean, you know, insinuating that you're a pedophile, I believe, maybe this might vary state by state, but that could be libel per se, meaning you don't even have to prove harm. You know, just all you have to do is demonstrate that he said it, and then you're pretty much, you're good to go.
Believe me that I've thought about it, and you know, one of the painful things about this whole episode is having to explain to your cancer center director just who the hell Mike Adams is, because he's purposely trying to slander, you know, to slime my cancer center and my university too, obviously with the intent of intimidating me to, you know, shut up. Fortunately, you know, the cancer center leadership has been fine, but you know, having these conversations with the cancer center director, cancer center lawyers that I've consulted, and basically there are a number, you know, this isn't the UK, it's the US. Suing would be incredibly expensive, and I really do think he wants me to sue. It's like he's goading me. Yeah, one time he actually showed up in the comments of Science Based Medicine. I don't know if you remember this. It's easy to miss because of the hundreds of comments we get all the time. Yeah. But he just said one word, discovery.
Yeah, it's tough. It's kind of a no-win scenario, because it's the bottom line is that the system doesn't work well enough to defend people who are truly innocent, who are truly being harmed. And if you're willing to be a completely unethical scumbag, you always are going to have the advantage, you know?
Right.
And that's the hard part.
You know, and he's also pretty clever. You know, he's very, you know, he asks it kind of like jacking off, you know, just asking questions, just speculating. But I think the worst one that may almost make me rethink was from a few days ago, when he tried to insinuate that I sexually abuse patients without actually saying it.
The thing is, he's sitting on millions of dollars.
No, that's the other thing. He's
so the big guy can always intimidate the little guy. They're holding all the chips in this game.
Oh yeah, he's rich as hell.
I
mean, I'm not poor, but spending hundreds of thousands of dollars would hurt like hell. You know.
Yeah, I know it. Believe me. That's the thing. Like,
well, no, I know. Well, you've been at the receiving end, so this is kind of ironic, because I was always fearing what you've been through, you know, being at the receiving end.
Yeah, no, I've been there. I've been slandered too, and made the same decision you did. It just wasn't worth doing anything about it. Just ignore it. Let it fade away. It's part of the risk of doing what we're doing. You know, if you're criticizing con artists, then you have con artists as enemies. And con artists are ruthless scumbags. They're psychopaths. Yep. You know, they will do things like make up horrific shit about you in order to deliberately smear your reputation or sue you because of your, even though they know they don't have a case against you, because they know they have the money to bully you and intimidate you. That's the kind of stuff that they do.
Yep.
The only thing we really have going for us is that we at least have a community behind us. But still, it's hard to put that up against millions of dollars, you know? All right, Kara, get us started with what's the word.
All right. So the word this week is hypnagogia. And this is, of course, a word that Steve should be quite familiar with as a neurologist. I came across this word the most recent time in Oliver Sacks's book, Hallucinations. Hypnagogia is defined as the state of drowsiness that immediately precedes sleep. And we often actually hear this word in its adjective form. In fact, it was coined in its adjective form, hypnagogic. And a hypnagogic hallucination is one that is really vivid. It's very dreamlike, but it occurs as one is falling asleep. So it's a little bit distinguished from a dream. And this is opposed to a very similar but kind of opposite word, which is hypnopompic. It's opposed to a hypnopompic hallucination, which occurs as you are waking up. Now, it's widely hypothesized that alien abduction hallucinations occur during these stages because they're super vivid and they often accompany this near total paralysis experience. And perhaps the most famous hypnagogic hallucination was described by Friedrich August Kekule von Stradonitz. He is the German chemist who elucidated
German?
Yes, he's very German. Okay. And he first described the benzene ring. And he claims that during this kind of hypnagogic state, this concept came to him because he saw a snake biting its own tail.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Have any of you guys ever had a hypnagogic or hypnopompic hallucination?
I don't think I have.
Sure, not as much as you, but I've had little ones.
David, have you ever had one?
I'm not sure. I've had a couple where I've thought I've seen people like standing over me, you know, momentarily, kind of freak me out.
So more subtle ones where you're not just sure if you're dreaming or not, or just had like a brief auditory or visual hallucination. But I've had full-blown hypnopompic and sometimes hypnagogic hallucinations, often triggered by being sleep deprived. But the ones that happen typically when I'm falling asleep, the classic episode is that sort of having a hard time falling fully asleep, and then I get stuck in this state. And the core features are that I'm paralyzed. Sleep paralysis is always that's the most common feature of these episodes, and that is sleep paralysis can happen independently. You guys ever just paralyzed upon waking up? Have you guys ever experienced that?
I have, yeah without
something
any hallucination.
Like it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But to put that in the context, I mean, that's natural. Actually, when you're sleeping, when you're having REM sleep, your body is paralyzed. You do not move. And the reason your body does that, it's very nice, because otherwise you would act out your dream and fall down the stairs, jump out a window. So this is something that's part of natural sleep. But so your brain is kind of screwing up. And so you've got, you know, one aspect of sleep, the paralysis, but you also, and also the hallucinations, but you're also kind of semi awake too. And that's kind of what hypnagogia is in a nutshell.
But often there's also a fear component, and the fear is just like neurological, just like your fear circuits are firing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that you're paralyzed, you know, and hallucinating doesn't help, and that that can sort of trigger fear as well. But the fear that you experience is way beyond that, because even when I know what's happening, because now like I totally know what's happening and it does help, but it doesn't prevent the fear response that you get in that situation.
So I want the content. Come on. You're stepping on the lead.
I've never had like aliens or anything like that. My hallucinations tend more towards the demonic end of the spectrum. It's usually that there's a very menacing presence in the room. Could be supernatural or not. Could be just like there's a thief in the room. Like there's a menacing presence in the room. That's also a very common feature. So imagine you're paralyzed and you can't even look to see if something is there. Like you're pretty sure there's something just out of your range of vision, but you can't turn your head.
No, can't
to confirm or not. But then the harder I try to like move or to turn my head or to wake up, often like I know what's happening, so I'm trying to wake up. The most common response is that I dream that I wake up. And I've had situations where I've dreamt I've woken up like a dozen times before I actually wake up.
Huh. Wow. That's frustrating. That's frustrating.
You must wake up so sweaty and just like, ugh, like exhausted from the stress.
I'm glad when I actually wake up, because like when I dream that I wake up, I'm not sure if I'm awake or not. I'm trying to test or convince myself. So like I'll do stuff and everything seems hyper real. So it's hard to tell, you know, like I walk across the room, I might go into the other room and sit down at my computer or whatever. And it all seems real to me at the time.
If you ever find yourself in that position again, there's two classic tests that you can do. I learned while I was studying lucid dreaming. If you want to know if you're in a dream, two things. Try to break the laws of physics, like say jump up in the air and then try to land a little more slowly than you would in Earth normal gravity. That's one key indicator that you're dreaming. The other one, and much easier, is to read something. Look at some text, open a book, read it, turn away, look back at the text. And almost invariably, that text will change. If that happens, you're dreaming.
The problem is this is not lucid dreaming. So it's, you don't really have that much control over what's happening. You know what I mean? It's more passive, like it's happening to you. Yeah, you're not really lucid. You know, that's the problem. So
So, Steve, I'm interested. Do you notice a difference between your hypnagogic hallucinations and your hypnopompic hallucinations? Is one more fear-inducing? Do they have different content? Or do you find that it's just kind of two sides of the same coin?
They're both very similar. The hypnopompic ones, when I'm waking up, I'm more likely to dream waking up in those episodes than when it's late at night. What does matter, the variable that seems to matter the most is how sleep deprived I am. The more sleep deprived I am, the worse it is. Dramatically so. And so, like, the times when I've been the most sleep deprived, I've had full blown hallucinations, like floating out of the bed or floating out of the chair, like physical sensations, like a fluttering sensation, so it's much more intense.
It's very common, even in a normal population. Sleep deprivation can induce these types of waking or sleeping hallucinations. And beyond that, it can obviously show up paired with different types of brain damage, with different types of sensory deficits, blindness, hearing
sleep
problems.
Sleep disorders,
mm-hmm. Definitely. Those are big catalysts for it. I don't want to forget about the etymology of this wonderful term. Hypnagogic is actually pretty recent term. It was coined by physician Louis Ferdinand Alfred Maury in 1868. His studies of consciousness and dream interpretation in France, where he first came up with this, were influential to Sigmund Freud. He actually predated him, and he's often mentioned in Freud's writings. Hypnagogic comes from the French hypnagogique, from the Greek hypnos, meaning sleep, and agogos, meaning leading to. So from an etymological perspective, the word breaks down to inducing sleep, and some uses are in line with that. Sometimes you'll hear it in the medical literature. A hypnagogic something is something that actually causes someone to fall asleep, but the general use of the term, and actually the general medical use of the term too, relates to the state of consciousness that occurs right between wakefulness and sleep.
It can involve any of your senses, really. One that's happened to me more than any other is purely auditory. And I think you could actually test this. So you might want to be interested in trying this at night. Tonight, when you go to sleep, as you're drowsing, you're very drowsy, you're dozing off and you're really, really sleepy, say your name to yourself over and over. And the times that I've done that, almost every time I do it, I eventually will hear my name out loud. I mean, this is completely indistinguishable from somebody 5 feet away just saying Bob. And it's striking, and you know that it's not real, but it's very convincing.
And we there are studies which show that there are those connections in the brain. You know, there are connections from the higher brain processing areas to the primary sensory processing areas, and they actually can create primary sensations. You know, your expectations, your beliefs, whatever, which actually relates to the next news item, or the first news item that we're going to talk about. This is a psychologist who are studying a particular magic trick. This is a very basic magic trick. You guys have all seen this, right? Where a magician is holding something and they throw it up in the air and it disappears, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Even close-up magic, this could be very, very effective. Now, when the trick was first developed, what the magicians would do is they would like hold a ball, for example, and they would toss the ball up into the air twice. And then on the third time, they would drop the ball out of sight and then make a motion as if they were tossing the ball up in the air. And they would use a lot of, magician tricks, to enhance the effect. And a lot of people watching this will think that they saw a ball fly up into the air and vanish.
Wow.
Makes sense.
Yeah. But later, magicians realized that, again, I'm not sure of the exact sequence of events, but essentially, you don't have to do the first two priming ones. You could just do it right straight away, and it works fine. So what psychologists did, very, very interesting, their question was, will this trick work if you're not even holding a ball? You know what I mean? So let's say because typically, like the magician, they'll have the ball, they'll be doing stuff with the ball or whatever it is. At some point, they distract the audience and they hide the ball, right? They put it somewhere else. And then they mime throwing the ball up in the air. So the psychologists were wondering, what if a magician did the same trick, but there was never a ball? They just mimed throwing it up in the air. Will people see something? So it's interesting that, you know, increasingly psychologists, neuroscientists are using like magic tricks or the skills that magicians developed to try to ask questions about how our brains process information. Mm-hmm. So again, this gets back to this idea. It's your expectation of what should be happening, and can that actually influence what you see? And not just what you think you see or what you remember seeing, but I mean, could it actually create a visual experience for you, you know? And again, as I was saying, the neuroanatomy is there. The higher visual, you know, cortex areas actually communicate back down to the primary visual area and affect what you see based upon what your higher cortical areas think is going on. Does that make sense? So, like, there's this interplay Sure. between the primary sensory areas and the higher sensory areas. So they influence each other. So when you see something, it's actually – that's a dynamic communication between higher and lower visual sensory areas where you see something, the part of your brain which assigns objects to images. Like for example, if you look at a glove, your retina is just a two-dimensional image. And then your primary visual cortex just will see the outline of the shape of a glove. And then your association visual cortex, your higher visual cortex, will say, that's a glove, right? Will then match mm-hmm. it to an actual object. And then once it does that, it communicates back to your primary visual cortex to make it look more like a glove, right? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And that all happens very, very quickly. So you just sure. experience seeing a glove and knowing that it's a glove, but that's a dynamic communication back and forth between those two parts of your brain. And so it's enhancing the outline. It's, you know, suppressing some information, enhancing other information, filling in the gaps, making judgments about distance and velocity and all these sorts of things. And then it sort of snaps into place, right? And this all happens seamlessly. So we don't realize it until you're confronted with an ambiguous situation when it doesn't snap into place yet, or it might shift from one construction to another construction, right? You guys have all experienced that.
Sure.
You think mm-hmm. you're looking at one thing, and suddenly you realize you're looking at something completely different. Your brain shifted, to a different dynamic construction of what it's seeing. Okay, so let's get back to the experiment. So they did this, you know, they made subjects watch videos. In several of the videos, magicians did regular tricks with objects. And then in a couple of the videos, they did nothing magical. And then in one of the videos, they did the illusion with nothing, right? Like they did the fake toss, but there was never any object anywhere in the video. They were just pantomiming the action of throwing something into the air. 32% of subjects reported seeing the non-existent object. Mm-hmm. So that's about a third. And 11% actually named a specific object. Like they didn't just see something. They saw a ball or
a coin. I even thought those numbers would have been higher.
Yeah. Well, all right, but this was silent video.
All right.
Essentially, they were isolating just the pantomime as a variable. So magicians do a lot of other things to get those numbers up higher. Like, for example, they will verbally suggest to you what they're doing.
Sure.
They will also like follow the non-existent object with their eyes so that they're using social cues. So then they may do other things as well. So they're using multiple sensory modalities plus suggestion, you know, plus social cueing, maybe some primings, multiple different, and then to get that number as high as possible. And again, every trick doesn't have to work for every person in the audience, but if you're getting 70-80%, that means for most people, 4 out of 5 times the tricks are going to work for them. And they'll forget the ones where they didn't quite see what happened, right? But if they thought they saw a ball fly up into the air and vanish, that's what they're going to remember. So this was just stripping away all of the other stuff and just getting it down to just its bare element. No suggestion, no visual cues, no social cues, just pantomiming the motion. And that was enough for a third of people to think they saw something that was never there, which is interesting. I mean, that's, you know, so with that, part of what that says is that you don't really need all of the magical tricks for there to be that type of illusion, right? Which means it can happen spontaneously in people just in their everyday life. And it doesn't have to happen that often in order for it to have a profound effect on the number of anecdotal reports of I saw Bigfoot or I saw an alien or a UFO or whatever, right? That means that, you know, people could have an ambiguous stimuli, and they could, you know, even if you look at just the 11%, 11% of people thought they saw an actual thing that was never there and were able to name it. That's a lot. Think about the millions of opportunities for people to remember seeing Bigfoot when there was nothing there, you know? That's why I always say, like, when people say, I know what I saw.
No, doesn't mean shit.
Yeah, no, you don't. You do not know what you saw.
You think you know what you saw.
You have a constructed memory of a constructed perception, all biased by your expectations and beliefs. That's what you have. You have no idea what you saw. You know, show me a video, right?
Oh, gosh, yeah. So many times that's been tested and proven. People's memories are so faulty. So faulty.
Yeah, we're not even talking about memory yet. We're just talking about just the perception. The expectation and your prior beliefs and your biases can actually construct what you see. To you, it's indistinguishable from any other sensory experience. It's as real to you as anything.
So all you can do is kind of be aware of it and ahead of time. There's nothing you can do to train yourself to be more savvy.
No, it's like you can't train yourself so that optical illusions don't work, right?
Right.
True.
The optical illusions work for you even when you know exactly what's going on. That's kind of the freaky part about them.
So this brings up an interesting question. When in development do children start to experience this? Because it relies on social cues and previous knowledge and expectations. And, you know, when you're an infant, you don't have any expectations.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, that sounds like a good follow-up research project to see at what age. Like, will five-year-olds have the same percentage response? Are there magic tricks that won't work on a three-year-old or a four-year-old because they haven't developed the preconceptions yet that drive it? Some magicians have, like, you know, Randy has said to us many times, it's harder to do magic for kids than for adults. Because adults are more predictable. Magicians know how adults are going to react to stimuli. They're easier to misdirect. That's probably partly why, because kids haven't necessarily fully developed all the mechanisms yet that magicians are manipulating, which is interesting. But yeah, so you'd have to ask, I guess, I'm sure the elements come in over time, you know, and it'd be interesting to break it down and try to see like what a typical 5-year-old or 4-year-old or 3-year-old, how their brains are constructing things, you know?
I read a situation where optical illusions did not work on somebody. Can you guess what the situation was?
They were blind.
Yeah. You're half right. They were blind
and they regained their vision later.
They got their sight, and optical illusions did not work on this guy because in a sense, this guy was receiving kind of like the raw optical feed. You know, the brain just was never trained to kind of try to interpret what he saw.
It's really common when people regain sight, regain hearing, regain any of these sensations after a long period of not having them. They refer to the experience as being very noisy.
Mm-hmm.
And overwhelming.
Yeah. So the key thing to keep in mind with this phenomenon and with optical illusions is that these are features, not bugs, right? This is our brain working properly. Our brain needs to do all of these things in order for us to have a seamless visual experience of reality. These, you know, evolution is good at optimizing systems. And so our visual systems have been optimized so that we can interact with the world around us. If it wasn't doing this, it would be like the person you described, Bob. The optical illusions wouldn't work. That's because their vision isn't working. It's not doing all the things that our vision is doing so that we see the things we need to see and we ignore the things that we don't need to see. And objects pop when they're supposed to. And we see three-dimensionality and we have some judgment of what's in front of what and distance and whatever. So all of those things are processing that our brains do and that they evolve to do. You know, the optical illusions are mainly exploiting just ambiguous stimuli, right? We're deliberately creating a situation in which we're gaming the system or we're creating ambiguous stimuli that the brain has a hard time knowing what assumptions to make, and therefore it can shift back and forth between two semi-stable constructions of the information.
Well, what about an octopus? What about an octopus? Did they, yeah, other did species, they suffer yeah. from optical illusions?
Who the hell knows?
And how would yeah, you yeah. test that?
Okay, Mr. Octopus, tell us your...
Sure. I mean, based on the behavior.
Well, design an experiment.
Yeah, you work on designing that experiment.
Yes, design the experiment.
Make a lot of money.
when I get some free time, I'll do that.
Yeah.
So, Evan, I understand there's been a bit of an update in the Piltdown hoax case.
Yes, fresh off the presses, in fact. Piltdown man, as I like to call him, the poster boy for scientific hoaxes. See what I did there, man, boy?
Yeah.
So I have to give you a brief explanation of Piltdown Man, or a reminder for most of our audience. So in 1912, amateur archaeologist Charles Dawson found a piece of a human-like skull in Pleistocene gravel beds near Piltdown Village in Sussex, England. Upon the discovery, Dawson contacted Arthur Smith Woodard, who was the keeper of geology at the Natural History Museum at the time. Woodard soon joined Dawson at the Piltdown site to look for additional remains. Together, they made more discoveries: flint tools, animal remains. They also found two more human-like skull fragments, but most importantly, they also uncovered a peculiar-looking jawbone with two teeth still embedded, and the jawbone and teeth seemed to resemble that of an ape-like creature. Ooh. Given the proximity of the skull fragments and the jawbone to each other, Dawson and Woodward concluded they must have belonged together, and that they must have been part of the same skull. So at a December meeting of that year at the Geological Society of London, Woodward argued that it was the skull of a man who he called Piltdown Man, a humanoid who had probably lived about a half million years ago. And the scientific community was all aflutter with curiosity and fascination and thankfully some skepticism as well. But eventually, during this time of scientific debate and conflict, Woodward's backers eventually won out, and the new species entered the textbooks. Eoanthropus Dawson, or Dawson's Dawn Man. And that's it. For over three decades, the Piltdown skull was accepted by the scientific community as an authentic artifact. Now, time and technology eventually caught up with the fossils, so that is to say, over the next few decades, more discoveries of different human-like fossils were being discovered all over the world, and the more that are discovered, the more it displaced Piltdown Man specimen, which found itself not fitting into the larger puzzle of human evolution. It rather showed itself to be a one-of-a-kind outcast. And by 1953, technology had become sophisticated enough for fluorine and nitrogen analysis of the Piltdown remains, and they clearly revealed the jawbone to have been of modern origins, and that of an orangutan, no less.
The thing is, all you had to do was drill down into the skull to know that it was a fake. But nobody did that. The reason is they took castings of the skull, and then they locked it away. No one had direct access to the skull for those 30 years. They were just examining casts of the skull.
But it also wasn't common practice back then to destroy pieces of paleo bone. Like, that was really like not okay to do back then until we realized how much we could learn from it.
Most paleontologists were ignoring it by the time it was revealed as a hoax. It had, and there was a lot of suspicion that it was an anomaly. Maybe it was a hoax, or just a mistake. You also have to realize that Dawson filed down the connection between the jaw and the skull so that you couldn't see if they fit together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The connections were not there. The connections were not there. So there was always suspicion and skepticism about Piltdown.
From the get-go, sure.
And every time a new fossil came out, the skepticism increased, and it was mainly ignored. And until finally someone said, oh, let's just take a look at it once for all. And as soon as they did, they realized it was clearly a modern hoax.
Right, once they got hold of the actual
right, but that was that item, confirmed not the by that. By the time they did that, that confirmed what everybody knew. It wasn't like it was a shock. You know what I mean? It didn't disrupt what the scientific community was believing at that point in time. It just confirmed, it's like, oh, that makes perfect sense. Of course it is, because it doesn't fit at all, you know, with everything else that we're discovering.
I think they were more shocked by the fact that scientists or otherwise would do some things along these lines.
Mm-hmm. So what's the update?
What the hell? But, of course, recent breaking news, as we know today, is that researchers have finished an 8-year study of Piltdown Man, and new tests, they show that the bones came from two or three different humans, plus one orangutan, and they conclude that
orangutan.
The orangutan. Thank you.
You don't have to pronounce it that way. It's okay. You just have to spell it that way.
No, Bob's right. I said no. I have it written in front of me as orangutan, but I said orangutan. But what the new analysis basically does is, you know, for a long time it was suspect as to who exactly was responsible for this. Was it Dawson? Was it Woodward? Was it some of these other characters? Well, they've come to the conclusion that it was in fact the prime suspect. The discoverer, Charles Dawson, was the hoaxer in all of this. And this research is published in Royal Society Open Science. They involved paleobiologists, historians, dental experts, and ancient DNA specialists to arrive at their conclusion. And the primary author of the study, Dr. Isabel De Groot, she said the following: "What we've been able to demonstrate is a signature, a fingerprint throughout all of these specimens, even including the second molar from the second Piltdown site." So real quick, let me explain that. The second Piltdown site, or Piltdown 2 as it's sometimes called, what she's referring to is a tooth which Dawson claimed he had found at a second Piltdown site a few kilometers away from the first one, and this was in 1915. And nobody else really, except for Dawson, knew about this other site or claimed to have taken any other, retrieved any artifacts from it. But what found out is that tooth that he claims he got at Piltdown 2 was actually came from the orangutan jaw that was found in Piltdown 1, the original one.
Wow.
So he lied.
You know, and those jaws, those bones, did he physically plant them there, or did he just find modern bones in a place and claim that they were ancient?
No. He planted them there. So he actually obtained a human skull that was about 700 years old, and he had access to them. He would have had access to collections of people who had old skulls, not fossilized, just old. And he also would have had access to, you know, an orangutan skull. And he got them. He aged them. He used acid to make them look old. He filed down
stains,
the connections.
Yep.
He pulled out the teeth and then put them back in with local gravel and embedded them in situ, and then found them with other people, you know, so that they would be there when he found them. No, though, it was a deliberate hoax.
Yeah, but it's, you know, 100+ years later, Piltdown Man still comes up in regular conversations. It's still a fascinating story and a great reminder about how even the best scientists can be fooled.
What I like about Piltdown Man is that how it's used, because you have true believers saying, see, you can't trust scientific pronouncements. They thought this was a legit skull for years and years and years, and it was just bullshit. So therefore, you cannot trust modern day scientific
pronouncements. Yeah, that's the
but of course,
creationists
but we say that. Yeah, but we say, well, look at even a hoax. Eventually, science will find it out.
You know, figured it out?
Yeah, that's true.
Good point, Dave.
Exactly.
Exactly right.
Not the creationists didn't figure it out.
Right. One usage of Piltdown that I kind of like is that Brian Deere called Andrew Wakefield's science Piltdown medicine.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yes.
I like
Piltdown's
it.
Piltdown's now an adjective. I love it. I love it.
All right, Bob, I understand there's a back door to get into black holes. What does that even mean?
Not so much get in, more get out. But researchers have proposed a solution for some pesky black hole problems by showing that natural processes could form a wormhole at the core, allowing mass and energy to escape through what everyone seems to be calling a back door. So, yes, a black hole back door. Evan, don't even say it. I know you
I
want to.
I can't even help myself right now.
I know.
You guys.
Just
it's
think
just
it.
Welling
just
up.
Think it. Don't say it. But now,
Mom
black holes. Black holes are, of course, the most awesome things in the universe. Don't even try to deny it. But the science describing them has some problems. Equations predict, for example, infinite density, infinite temperature, and curvature at a black hole's central singularity. And infinities basically are just not nice. Generally, they mean that there's a missing piece to your theory. So maybe there's a new theory that could remove the infinities of a black hole, just like quantum mechanics did for classical physics. And that has been the hope for many years for what's being called quantum gravity. But maybe we don't need a completely new theory, to remove the infinities. Maybe we could just, we just needed to look at a black hole singularity differently. And that's exactly what researchers at the Institute of Corpuscular Physics, I love it, in Valencia.
What an awesome
name. Gonzalo, Yeah, right.
What's corpuscular physics?
That's a good question.
Oh, a minute particle regarded as the basic constituent of matter or light, historically.
Awesome. So they looked at black hole singularities not as infinity-producing mysteries, but as a geometric structural imperfection in space-time. Gonzalo almost said, he had a really good quote on this. He said, just as crystals have imperfections in their microscopic structure, the central region of a black hole can be interpreted as an anomaly in space-time, which requires new geometric elements in order to be able to describe them more precisely. So that's exactly what they're doing here. So once they examined these singularities from this perspective, something interesting happened. In their model, out popped this, the center of the black hole became a spherical surface, which the team interpret to be a wormhole. I'm not sure why they go from spherical surface to wormhole. I wasn't able to find out why they made that kind of conceptual leap, but that's what they're going with. So this door in space-time at the center of a black hole that they're hypothesizing is what makes those annoying infinities disappear, because the mass energy that's absorbed into the black hole do not compress into this puff of problematic infinities, but or a cosmological blue screen, if you will, but it just escapes somewhere else, perhaps another part of space-time. Is what they're saying. So, which is basically what wormholes are said to do. So, but if that's not enough, there's another benefit to this hypothesis. We've long thought that, to hold open a wormhole to transmit data, say, or even an astronaut, you need something. What is this substance called, guys? What do you need to prop open a wormhole so that it's
antimatter?
Big enough? Nope, exotic matter. It's called exotic matter.
That's exotic matter.
Right. And this is supposed to have negative energy density, something that we've never seen in nature and which may not even exist at all. So if this theory or hypothesis is correct, you wouldn't need to create exotic matter because its whole existence essentially becomes obviated, if that's even a valid form of that word.
What about erotic matter? Could you use that?
Always.
Yeah, so the exotic matter is just no longer needed because it's actually occurring naturally in the wormhole itself. So I know what you're thinking now. What does this mean for an astronaut going through this? So the idea is that this wormhole in its natural state would be super tiny, like the size of an atomic nucleus. Nothing really is going to get through there. But the bigger or the more that the black hole has an electric charge, the bigger the wormhole is. And so if it has enough charge, it'll be big enough so that an astronaut will go through there. Now, you still kind of get spaghettified because you have some major tidal forces going on. So that's
kind
not
of,
that's
kind
not
of,
a,
kind
yeah.
of die.
Kind of so it's not fun, virgin, but right? but weirdly, what they say is that you would get recompacted as you exit the wormhole. So sure, you're not going to live, but you'll kind of look kind of like how you did when you went before you went in. You wouldn't be spaghetti; you'd be kind of conglomerated back together in a way.
I don't think biology works that way, though. Physics might, but biology doesn't.
Yeah, you look somewhat human-like, but it's certainly not living. So that's their argument. You know, I wasn't able to find any commentary by a physicist debunking this. I didn't get a chance to talk to two of my go-to physicists to get to comment on this, but I haven't found any definitive smackdown by somebody who knows a lot more about this shit than I do.
Maybe we'll hear from them and give an update next week.
I'll give an update, sure.
David.
Yes.
So far and away, the most common email we got in the past week.
Oh,
not just you.
Maybe in the past ever.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Seriously. Woo. Has been asking us about all of these red blotches on the athletes that we're seeing in the Olympics.
Here I was kind of on vacation, and then like beginning Sunday night after Michael Phelps competed in the 4x100 meter relay, and people noticed these purpley red circular blotches all over his shoulders and back. The email lit up, and I was like, I recognize them right away. I know you recognize
me
them
too.
Right
yeah,
away.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. Oh man.
Yes, it's something called cupping, and it's part of traditional Chinese medicine, although that's the way it's most commonly represented, but it appears to have popped up in many cultures over many times, dating back to the ancient Egyptians even. And basically it involves applying suction to these cups. And the way they usually do it is they heat up the air in the cup with a candle or a lighter and then apply it to the skin, and you know, as the air cools, it forms a suction and pulls the skin into the cup, forming a seal. And they would just do this and leave these on from somewhere between 5 and 15 minutes each. And the idea is that it somehow draws out the toxins, or you know, or and it,
whatever that means,
whatever that means. And there's another form of cupping that is, where after the cupping is done, they will put a nick in the skin so that it actually bleeds, which is basically bloodletting. Oh. You know, it's bloodletting.
It's bloodletting. Gosh. Yeah.
Yeah, because cupping is just a hickey, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a big
hickey. Pretty much. Yeah, basically it is. But David, aren't they also claiming that not just removing toxins, but I read often that they say that it increases blood flow.
It supposedly increases blood flow. And if you listen to the, you know, some of the traditional Chinese medicine practitioners, they will say, oh, well, it improves the flow of qi, of course, because everything that they do supposedly does that, acupuncture or whatever. Yes, it's a genuine fad. There's all sorts of athletes with these marks on their body. There was a
celebrities too.
Another female swimmer. There was a male gymnast. There were a couple others, and some of the news stories that I saw were oh so credulous. NBC News was really bad.
They were horrible. I was screaming at the TV. It was pathetic. You know, I understand you want to be a little, you want to take it a little bit easy because NBC is hosting the Olympics. And if they start kind of criticizing the athletes, maybe they won't do interviews. I can kind of see that angle, but it's also very frustrating when the news part of NBC outside of the Olympics is just, they just described it. All they did is describe it. There was not one skeptical word in the entire thing.
Right. They interviewed the trainer for the swim team who...
Ooh, I didn't see that.
Where he was basically going on about the usual things. It supposedly increases... Oh, also lymphatic drainage. It supposedly increases lymphatic drainage. All of this is kind of ridiculous because basically if you're applying suction to the skin of sufficient quantity, and if you look at those pictures... You know, it pulls the skin up pretty far into those cups. It's not, you know...
Really far.
You're actually blocking blood flow and breaking capillaries. It's what makes the mark.
It's a hickey.
It makes the mark. It's what makes the mark.
It's just blood leaking under the skin.
Right. Yeah, they're broken capillaries.
Now everyone who's watching it's, oh, man, yeah. I got to try this cupping too. Look what it did for Michael Phelps.
That's the problem.
My local news station, I mean, this was the template for, I'm sure, a million, you know, 1,000 local news stations. Like, my local news station, or one of them, sent, you know, the local NBC affiliate sent one of their anchormen to a woo clinic, you know, and he had cupping done, and it was a totally credulous report, and it made it look all really cool. And I'm sure in cities all over the U.S., the same sorts of stories were being broadcast.
4 years ago, it was kinesio tape. You guys remember this?
The color tape
on all the athletes?
Oh, that's, yeah.
No, they're still, some people are still wearing that.
KT is number one on the list of what we're going to talk about right after
The cupping.
Oh, okay. So, okay.
Yeah, after cupping, so, for sure.
The cupping, you know, if you go through the evidence, there are even, you know, systematic reviews of the evidence. The studies are crappy. They don't really show anything. There might be some placebo effect. There's no real evidence that it does anything that is claimed for it. And principles of science-based medicine, which all of hopefully listeners understand, if you take equivocal clinical evidence plus no good scientific, you know, basic science physiologic rationale and combine them, it's negative studies. You know, it doesn't work.
Yep.
Yeah, we're seeing the typical pattern that we see for treatments which don't work. Bunch of crappy studies. Any study that's halfway decent is basically negative.
But it's worse. It's worse than that, though. Here's bringing it all back to quackademic medicine. You know, bringing it all back to that. Looking at a lot of these stories found integrative medicine doctors at various universities who would talk about cupping. You know, and one of them was Dr. Perlman at Duke University, who basically said, oh, he was happy to see those marks on Michael Phelps because it meant that, you know, that integration was popular. You know, it was becoming mainstream. You know, he said this. And reading that story just made me want to pull my hair out. Even as he's admitting there's no evidence that this does anything other than leave welts, he's basically happy. And then here's the other thing. And both he and someone whose name I forget from the Mayo Clinic said basically the same thing. Well, the difference here between the cupping that Michael Phelps got and what we do is, you know, we would give you the complete integrative medicine evaluation, of which cupping is just a part, as opposed to just the cupping alone. So they're like latching onto this to make cupping, you know, the gateway woo to bring them in to, you know, the integrative medicine clinics.
And Kara, I understand that cupping is not the only pseudoscience in the Olympics.
Yeah, you know, I came across a really great article this week in Policy Options magazine, which is a Canadian publication, and it was written by Timothy Caulfield. You may remember Timothy because he's the author of the 2015 book, Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything? When Celebrity Culture and Science and
Isn't she also the one who does the vaginal steaming?
Oh, she does everything.
She does.
She does everything. Which is why there's enough to fill an entire book about
it. That's right. Bras cause cancer, all kinds of good stuff.
Yeah. So you know, Timothy Caulfield, he writes a lot of these kind of debunking, these very skeptical articles, and he focused in this one on five things that are very common amongst Olympic athletes. And he opens it with an anecdote about going to the U.S. Olympic gymnastic trials in San Jose prior to the Rio Olympics and running into Carrie Strug. And what was she doing there? She was working a booth for KT tape.
Man.
And this is a very common practice, this kinesio tape. You've seen it on athletes going all the way up from Olympic athletes all the way down to your local friend, you know, who's a runner.
I've seen it on racehorses.
You've seen it on racehorses. Yeah, this really brightly colored tape. You'll see it on their arms, their legs, their shoulders, their stomachs, anywhere you get their thighs, anywhere you can see it. This company, KT Tape, is one of the biggest sponsors of the Olympics this year. They're putting a lot of money into it. And there's an article in Fox Business that is just like not even hiding the fact that this guy is like, this is a market that we have to tap into. These athletes will help us sell this product. Unfortunately, for kinesio tape, there is no evidence to support its efficacy. There are multiple meta-analyses online that take some of the best studies in existence about kinesio tape. And those articles actually show that there's no outcome across a lot of different areas. So like knee pain, shoulder pain, chronic low back pain, plantar fasciitis, a bunch of different musculoskeletal conditions, kind of a lot of the thing, lymphatic problems, elevated muscle strength, range of movement. A lot of these things have been looked at. And the only thing where there does seem to be a slight effect size, like you said, David, in some kind of crummy studies, is about short-term pain reduction. And there is a good chance that could be placebo, because it's very hard to use a placebo tape versus kinesio tape, because if kinesio tape actually doesn't do anything, then tape wouldn't do anything
it's
either.
It's kind of the same problem with homeopathy studies.
It's really, yeah, exactly. It's hard to give a sugar pill when you're just taking a sugar pill. So, yeah, lots of studies to show that KT tape does absolutely nothing to help you. And, you know, Caulfield, the author, even mentions it in part of his article. It's kind of funny. He's like, when you think about it, how could this product possibly work? How could putting tape on the surface of your skin help resolve an issue with the underlying tendon, bone, or muscle? It just doesn't make sense physically.
Yeah. There's no plausibility to it.
There's no plausibility to it. Yeah, this is, you know, an industry. They make a lot of money, and a lot of Olympic athletes, you know, fall victim to it and buy into it, and then help them sell their product inadvertently. Sure. All right, another one. Breathing nasal strips. These are interesting, and I'm interested in you guys' take, because I haven't surveyed. They don't work at all to improve breathing, improve oxygen intake, improve performance, improve energy. None of that. All bunk. All the studies show that they're not. Do they work with snoring?
They do hold your nose open a little bit, but that's not really the problem with snoring.
It's a throat phenomenon.
Yeah.
Well, it's different for different people, no? Like, people can, you know, there's not a one-size-fits-all snore.
I mean, I haven't really looked into it, so to be honest, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm interested, because that's ultimately what they're marketed as, yet that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about using nasal strips to improve athletic performance. tons of research. All of it shows it's bunk. And that's another one that you mentioned, Evan. You will see horses with nasal strips on them.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
It's so strange. Okay, here's another one. IV hydration.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. No evidence to support the practice. In fact, there is some evidence that shows, I love the way he worded this in the article, quote, available evidence suggests that simply using an apparatus called the mouth, aka drinking, is usually the more efficient way to hydrate. There are literally studies that show you get more hydrated when you drink.
IV hydration will just make you pee. That's all it'll do.
There you go. It's really good if you have rhabdo. It's probably not good for anything else. Cryotherapy and icing. We've talked in depth on the show about cryotherapy, of course. But there's also a growing body of evidence that shows putting an ice pack on an injured muscle or a sprain actually does no good and could potentially do harm because it can delay the kind of natural healing process that would occur when you have muscle damage.
Really?
Yeah. So there's very, very little evidence in the literature that supports the practice of icing a muscle strain. And there's actually some evidence that, and it's spotty, it's all over the place, but there is actually some evidence that shows, and there's a growing grassroots understanding among physical therapists that putting ice on it can actually delay your healing process. And then lastly, what's another huge one? There's a big study that shows huge. Before I get to the last one, this I love. Did you guys see that the FDA put out a consumer health poster called Whole Body Cryotherapy, a quote, cool trend that lacks evidence and poses risks? The FDA is basically saying, guys, be careful, don't do it. There's even a pull quote from it that says, based on purported health benefits seen in many promotions for cryotherapy spas, consumers may incorrectly believe that the FDA has cleared or approved WBC devices as safe and effective to treat medical conditions. That is not the case.
Yeah, there's a clinic that has one of those within walking distance of my house. It drives me nuts.
Kara, I sent that article to you and told you to forward it to Joe Rogan.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes, totally.
Multivitamins and supplements. There's a study that I found that shows using a systematic review of dietary supplement use by athletes that athletes use supplements at a significantly higher rate than the general population. And again, multiple studies show that there is not a lot of data to support, actually very minimal evidence to support any sort of supplementation or vitamin usage to improve athletic performance, except generally with substances that are banned anyway.
Yeah, they train their ass off. They work really hard. They exercise, and
some of them even have genetic things that make
genetics.
Them better.
Well, yeah, they have
Usain Bolt,
mitochondria.
Yeah.
They have
muscles. But it's the red splotch on their back that made them win.
Right? That's right.
Absolutely. All the training and everything. Yeah. Okay, let's move on to this is going to be actually an installment of the dumbest thing of the week. This really pissed me off. Triggered by an email I got from John White, although I was starting to see some of this myself. John writes, I'm a huge fan of the show and your great courses series. I'm writing you because I wanted your take on all the controversy and conspiracy surrounding Hillary Clinton's health. Recently, Martin Shkreli said he believed she had Parkinson's disease. There was a news story on Hannity about her health and needing assistance upstairs. There is the video of her having what appears to be a small seizure when talking to reporters. All right, then he goes on a little bit more detail. But basically, this is all filed under sort of armchair diagnosis, right?
Yeah, right.
But Martin Shkreli, you guys remember who Martin Shkreli is.
Oh, yes.
The biggest scumbag in the world.
Yeah, that's right.
Famous for being a scumbag.
He's up there, definitely.
Infamous.
But anyway, yeah, so he bought a company that was selling a drug for a rare disease for like $8 a pill and decided to increase the price to like $700 a pill or something.
Yeah.
And then tried to justify, say, this is going to fund research and we're going to cure diseases and whatever. No one bought it. So Shkreli puts out a video, like he didn't. He should just be laying low, this guy, right? He's already had his 15 minutes of scumbag thing.
He's shameless.
Infamy.
Yeah. In the video, and so Martin Shkreli, if you haven't guessed, he's the dumbest guy of the week. In the video,
Again.
He says that, you know, he's looked at these videos of Hillary Clinton, and because he's, you know, he's been involved in pharmaceutical research, right? Like, this guy is a scientist.
Would he like to show me his neurology board certification?
Yeah. He says, I'm not a neurologist. I'm not a doctor. But, hey, they don't call me Pharma Bro for nothing. You know, I know what I'm talking about. Then he builds a case that Hillary Clinton has Parkinson's disease because of, like, this one video where she stumbles and this other video where, I mean, it's kind of a goofy video where she's making an exaggerated startle response to a reporter asking a question. I think it was about Elizabeth Warren or something. She's like feigning an exaggerated reaction. Like, what are you saying? You know, and it looks kind of goofy, but he's saying that this is dystonia. Like, that movement was dystonia, and her tripping was a Parkinsonian freeze. So, Martin Shkreli has absolutely no effing idea what he's talking about.
Doesn't stop him from talking.
Yeah, not only should you not make armchair diagnoses, you especially shouldn't do it if you have no expertise whatsoever. And being a scumbag for this pharmaceutical industry doesn't make you an expert in anything.
Except scumbaggery.
And of course, you know, what I like to consider perhaps the dumbest pundit in the world, Sean Hannity,
Come on. Negative Hillary must be good. That's Sean.
Movement disorders are like one of those things that you can diagnose from a video. You know, I never make diagnoses online or whatever, but you know, with things like this that are in the public domain, I can comment on Shkreli's comment about this. So what she was doing in that video when she was moving her head was not dystonia. It was not Parkinson's disease. It wasn't a seizure. It was clearly voluntary. It was nothing neurological. That was voluntary. You know, Parkinson's disease is not something you can hide. It is something that's very visual. That's what we call an across-the-room diagnosis. I could get a glance at somebody and know that they have Parkinson's disease. It affects the way your face looks. It affects the way you talk. It affects the way you walk. It affects the way you move. And even with medication, if you could obviously improve the symptoms, especially in the early stages with medication, but never to the point where you can escape diagnosis. You know how many thousands of hours has Hillary Clinton been in the public, you know, with cameras and video cameras on her over the last year.
Yeah, she couldn't.
Or more.
She doesn't control that. Michael J. Fox in the early days. Like, he was on set. They chose which clips to use.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which takes to use.
Exactly. They would get little 30-second clips of him.
Yeah. You can't do that when you're in the public eye constantly.
No, absolutely not. So he's talking out his ass about this. Really, it's like embarrassing what he's saying. And while he's simultaneously trying to convince you that he knows what he's talking about, what he's saying is utterly naive. It's just, don't think you have clinical expertise because you have non-clinical expertise. It's totally different. So he got that completely wrong. And then, of course, now there's this meme going around that Hillary Clinton is having seizures, and that video is like the main evidence for it. It's not a seizure. Just stop it. Please. You don't know what you're talking about. I know, David, you commented on this too. I just don't think – I think people are a little bit too free with, you know, throwing around clinical diagnoses. Like, even for Donald Trump.
I mean, in fairness, it makes me very uneasy to hear all of these pundits speculating about Trump's mental health. You know, I despise Trump pretty much as much as almost anyone, but it makes me uncomfortable to hear people say that stuff. Stop it.
Yeah, just don't make a clinical diagnosis.
Right.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and I think the funny thing is it's scaremongering on one side of the aisle to, you know, this is common in election years, especially when you can use somebody's or attempt to use somebody's age against them.
Absolutely.
And Hillary Clinton is not a spring chicken. You know, I think she's 70 years old, but so's Donald Trump.
Right, they're the same age. They're within a year.
But it's just now just a political tactic. You're right, David, that the pundits are like, oh, this is a meme now. Hillary's sick. Oh, that's how we're going to get her. We're going to build this case that Hillary's not medically fit to be president.
And,
you know?
And start cherry picking certain images or things to fit that narrative.
Yes, exactly. They're just confirmation bias at that point.
And I mean, Trump himself has even been saying this, too.
Sure.
Yes. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah,
it's scurrilous.
You can invent any meme. You can invent a meme that Trump has dementia, and then let's build a case for that. You know what I mean? Whatever. I'm sure you could do that if somebody wanted to do that. You could be a cherry pick videos, and everyone's going to have a brain fart after thousands of hours on the campaign trail, or use the wrong word or whatever. Remember, you guys remember back to Kerry? You're too young for this, but President Ford.
Oh, yeah.
Got a reputation for being clumsy. And then, of course, that's it. Every time the guy stumbled or tripped, it reinforced the narrative that he was clumsy.
I mean, he had old football injuries, as I recall, that occasionally, you know, acted up.
But even I don't even know that there's anything to it. I mean, everyone trips.
No, I know.
Again, if you're being videotaped for thousands of hours, you know, you could build, that's a lot of raw material. You could build any narrative out of
that. Sure, you could. That's
how many times do you just stumble or trip on your everyday life? All the time. Doesn't mean a thing.
Yeah, I remember one specific scenario, Steve, where he did trip and he had a fall. But actually, if you looked at it in slow motion, they said, he actually made some amazing saves while he was falling. It could have been so much worse. And he was actually fairly adroit, you know?
Yeah. All right, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week.
Ooh.
The theme is the Olympics.
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. What else could it be?
And there are four items.
Oh.
Four items. Okay.
Painful.
Here they are. Item number one. After the 1924 Paris Olympic Games, fencers from Italy and Hungary fought a real duel to settle a scoring dispute. And that was a fencing duel, not a gun duel, pistol duel. Item number two, women did not compete in the Olympics until 1936. Item number three, Olympic officials will soon begin testing for a new kind of cheating, gene doping. And item number four, the 1912 Stockholm Games featured a competition in arts and literature, introduced by Baron Pierre de Coubertin, who won the gold medal in that event. All right. Well, David, as our guest, you get to go first.
Oh, great. So I don't get any hints from anyone else.
You get to lead the way.
So three of these are true and one is fiction.
Okay. I'm going to say it's the women's Olympics in 1936, or the women not being able to compete till 1936.
You think that one's the fiction?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's really short and sweet.
Okay. Yeah, you could comment on that one if you want.
I did not know, but that is my best guess.
Okay, Bob, you go next.
The fencing, I mean, sure, Italy and Hungary. I mean, that's back in the 20s. I mean, what the hell? It's possible for sure. Women not competing. Yeah, I might think that's fiction, but I'm not going to say that's fiction. I'm going to jump to four, the arts and literature. Yeah, I think they've had some wacky stuff. Didn't they have – I remember they had some sort of gymnastic-type event like 10, 12, 15 years ago where it was really kind of ornamental movements with the sticks with the long flowing cloth or tape or whatever.
Not doing that one anymore? Like that was like floor dancing or something?
It was.
That's called rhythmic gymnastics.
Maypole or
– Wait, it's called rhythmic gymnastics and it's still real.
Wait, is it in the – yes, it's real, but is it in the Olympics?
Yes.
Oh, remember that one year where they had synchronized swimming?
No, rhythmic gymnastics is real.
Wait a second. Are you sure? All right. This is my memory. Apparently a false memory. My memory was that they tried it for a couple Olympics or whatever, and they were basically giving out – everyone was doing so well. They gave out like perfect scores very quickly, and they figured this is just not right for the Olympics. And I have not seen it in a dog's age. I don't remember seeing it. And I've been watching a lot of Olympics, especially this time around. I have not seen it, so I'm a little skeptical.
You're talking about rhythmic gymnastics still?
But are you talking about the one where they've got the stick with the flowing cloth stuff, the long
– It's called a ribbon?
Yeah. Ribbon. Effing word. Ribbon. Cloth.
Yeah,
tape.
There's a loop. And there's a ball. Yeah.
So it's still in there. Wow, that's a powerful false memory. Okay, whatever. But I guess my point was that it's especially back in 1912. I'm kind of buying it. The one that rankles me a little bit, or the most, is the gene doping one. Because think about that, what that would involve. You would need a significant genetic profile from everybody. How many people? We've got over 200 some odd people just for the United States. Just seems like a lot of work. And I don't think I could at this point actually see some governments trying to do that. But I really think we're just not at that point yet where we're going to, you know, dope you genetically and try to enhance you. I mean, I think it's incredibly irresponsible to even try that on people now. So I'm going to have to go with that one. Fiction.
Okay, Evan.
All right. Let's see. 24 Paris Olympic Games fencers. They fought a real duel. They fenced a real duel to settle a scoring dispute. Italy and Hungary. Hadn't heard this one before. So that's interesting. I wouldn't be surprised if that one turns out to be true. Three of these are true. The next one, women didn't compete in the Olympics till 1936. Okay. I might be leaning with David on this one and thinking that this one's going to be the fiction. I have some recall of tennis, and I think there was a British Olympian champion, and she was like the biggest thing going, and I think she competed in the Olympics, and I think it was before 1936. I think. Don't know for sure, though. Olympics.
Holy crap. Rhythmic gymnastics really is in the 2016 Olympics.
There you go.
Damn.
There you go.
I thought that was dead. Okay.
Well, I'm going to keep. I have to check that out. No.
It's really corrected. They're good athletes.
The gene doping one, that's interesting. I wonder if that arose really out of the 2008 Olympics with China and Beijing and kind of sort of some of the sketchy things they were doing during those Olympics. I wouldn't be surprised if that was science based on that. And then 1912 Stockholm Games, arts and literature. Gold medal in that event. Yeah, you know, maybe chess was once a Olympic sport as well. I don't quite remember that. But so something like maybe arts and literature. Yeah, you know, competitions come and go. They're always adding things. They're always subtracting things. So this could have been one of those things. I guess I'm going to have to go with David and the Olympics until 1936, because I seem to have a recollection of tennis being done before them by the women.
And Kara.
After the 1924 Paris Olympic Games, fencers from Italy and Hungary fought a real duel to settle a scoring dispute. Now that you say it's a fencing duel, it seems more reasonable. I was hoping it was a gun duel. I might say that's science. Women did not compete in the Olympics until 1936. I have no idea. I don't know. Olympic officials will soon begin testing for a new kind of cheating, gene doping. First of all, what the hell is gene doping? How can you dope your genes? Like gene therapy? That's not even a thing to improve performance. I don't even know how that would happen. So this seems really silly, but it also wouldn't be beyond the capacity of like wasteful spending for the Olympics to like test for something that's not even really an issue. 1912 Stockholm Games featured a competition in arts and literature. What does that even mean? Oh, and it was introduced by the person that gold medaled, of course. They're like, I'll introduce a competition where to win, you have to be the best me. Two of them seem silly, but I also know that the women's suffrage actually passed in the U.S. in 1920, 16 years before this claim that women could compete. I know that part of the reason that suffrage finally went through is because the tides had changed so much, because so many women were working, so many women were doing the kinds of things that historically we only thought that men could do. So the only reason this one really sticks out to me is that it seems weird that women wouldn't compete in the Olympics until after the 19th Amendment was ratified. So I'm going to GWDE. And say it was that women didn't compete until 36.
All right. So, Bob, you're on your own this week. We'll see how you do. We'll start with number one.
I'm sure he's thinking about it right now.
I am.
After the 1924 Paris Olympic Games, fencers from Italy and Hungary fought a real duel to settle a scoring dispute. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yes.
It'd be funny if he swept us on
Epee
that
or one. Saber?
Saber.
Okay.
They fought a saber duel for an hour on like Whoa. The border of Hungary. Oh.
You better and have been an Olympic athlete.
Finally, the crowd sort of had to stop it because they had cut themselves up so much. and then they both agreed that, I guess after an hour of slicing each other up, that
a tie?
Their honor was restored.
Okay.
Oh, jeez.
Of course.
Adolfo Contrunei.
Oh, good.
Right, but with the Italian foil team. And Giorgio Santelli, who what? Actually fought for his father. So the dispute was with his 60-year-old father, but he invoked the code of duello and said that he wanted to fight with him. So the two guys fought.
Whoa, that seems so unfair.
Sounds like the Hunger Games or something.
Yeah,
he's like, I kind of old to duel you, so I'm going to get my hot, athletic young son to do it.
That's what you get.
I volunteer as tribute.
Yeah, exactly. They fought with heavy sabers. That also wasn't the only duel that was fought. Yeah, so 4 months later, there was another duel. That another saber duel was fought between Georgi Kovacs, a Hungarian judge at the games, involved in the causes of the earlier duel. So it kind of led to a second follow-up duel between two other guys. Kind of silly. So yeah, they were still fighting actual duels back in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to number four. The 1912 Stockholm Games featured a competition in arts and literature introduced by Baron Pierre de Coubertin, who won the gold medal in that event. You all think that one is science, and that one is also science. Do you guys recognize the name?
No.
Baron Pierre de Coubertin. Mm-mm. He is the father of the modern Olympics. He's the guy who invented the Olympics or brought them back, you know.
Holy crap.
So I guess not every one of his ideas were good.
Yeah, so I guess he had a little street cred. He had the political power. It's like, hey, I want a gold medal in something I could win. So he made one in literature, and then he won. Yay.
So what was it? Like a trivia event? Or did you have to like write a poem on the clock?
Dirty limericks.
I don't know.
Dirty limericks.
Submit a piece of literature that you wrote.
I would think.
It's kind of
That's
silly.
A crappy Olympic sport.
Yeah. The most boring event ever.
The judges are reading it now. Yeah. Yeah, right, exactly.
All right, let's go to number two. Women did not compete in the Olympics until 1936.
Uh-oh.
Evan, Karen, David, you think this one is the fiction. Bob thinks this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
The fiction.
Oh, my gosh.
I knew it had to be earlier than that.
What year? What year do you think?
Like the turn of the century, right?
Because 1936 was the was the Berlin Olympics.
The Nazi.
You know, the Nazi games.
Yeah.
The
Nazi. The
Nazis.
That's right. 1900, they had two events. There were very few events when things started. Women only competed in two events in 1900, golf and tennis. And in
tennis.
Fact,
Wait,
there's a
are
story.
You sure? I thought it was golf and rhythmic gymnastics.
It was golf and tennis. The woman who won the gold medal in golf was an American who was vacationing in Paris and didn't even realize that she was entering the Olympics. She just thought that she was there for like a carnival. I thought, oh, look, the friendly golf tournament at the carnival I'll play. And she won the gold medal in
That's amazing.
It sounds like
she didn't find out until she got home to the United States.
She was like a hometown hero by then.
Yeah. So I mean the first years of the Olympics were a total mess. They were a complete mess. They were not the well-oiled machine that we know the Olympics by today. I mean,
the well-oiled corrupt machine that they are now.
Yeah, well-oiled Rio.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, like they weren't even keeping track of who was from what country, and it was just it was chaos. It was utter chaos. All right. All of this means that
Bob
Olympic
lost.
Officials will soon begin testing for a new kind of cheating. Gene doping is actually science. That was the tricky one in here.
Jeez, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. So this is an article in Chemical and Engineering News. Ugh. Talks about the fact that the Olympics committees are already gearing up to test for gene doping by looking for they're developing multiple analytic techniques looking for synthetic DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Another strategy is to look for the presence of viruses used to transport DNA. to looking for markers for gene doping. Now, again, which doesn't necessarily mean that this is a viable technology at this point in time. I would be surprised. I mean, it also doesn't mean that people aren't trying it, right? So people could be doing it even though it's not very safe and effective. What they're doing mainly is inserting genes that increase the production of red blood cells.
Right.
So it's a way
Erythropoietin.
Backdoor way of blood doping.
Is that what Lance Armstrong was doing?
No, he was
just blood doping.
They were blood doping.
Yeah, they were blood doping. Or genes for growth factors. You know, so So rather than taking the hormones themselves or the products, you just get the gene inserted by a virus or something.
And then you can pass potentially a test.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're trying to keep one step ahead of the cheaters, you know.
Okay.
It's kind of the idea here.
Not that dumb.
Yeah.
The problem is once that's viable, won't there be genetic treatments for... Like, I would think that once that's viable, we'll also be doing these kinds of vector-borne genetic treatments.
Like, and for disease?
So just testing for the vector is going to, like, be really hard to tell the difference. It's easy now if you're just testing for a substance.
Athletes will claim that they had some genetic disease that needed to be treated.
Exactly.
And that's why they have gene doping vectors in their body, right?
Yeah.
That's why they would need gene samples beforehand.
Yeah, I'm just trying to stay one step ahead of the committee that's one step ahead of me.
Right.
Well done, Kara.
It is an arms race, you know. It's a shame. There's been a lot of scandals this time around about.
Hell yeah, Russia.
Yeah, about doping. The Russian swimmer. You guys, she was like practically booed out of the pool.
But it's always been that way, right? It's even that way with synthetic drugs. Like the DEA. It's so hard for them to keep up with just like what's on the street because these chemists are just always, you know, cheating the drug tests. It's like, oh, we'll just change this one part of the structure around, and now it won't show up on that test that they use anymore. It's an arms race, like you said.
Yeah. How about just compete? You know, just...
Right.
All right. Well, good job, guys. Bob, better luck next week.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I'm trying so hard not to care.
But you learned about ribbon gymnastics. I mean...
Yeah, you learned about rhythmic. I hope you watch it, Bob. 19th and 20th. The 19th are the qualifiers. The 20th are the competitions.
All right, Evan, give us the quote.
Objectivity cannot be equated with mental blankness. Rather, objectivity resides in recognizing your preferences and then subjecting them to especially harsh scrutiny, and also in a willingness to revise or abandon your theories when the tests fail, as they usually do. Written by Stephen Jay Gould. From the Lying Stones of Marrakesh.
Awesome. Gould. Love that guy.
Gould. Nice. Very nice.
Gosh, infinitely quotable fellow. I mean, just everything. He's great. Read anything by him and you will not be disappointed.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thanks for inviting me. It's cool.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. Uh-huh.